I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. Today, we have part two of our interview with David Hawk. Dave was a top professional bodybuilder in the 1980s. He won the MPC USA in 1985, and then he went on to win the World Games in London, which qualified him to be a professional. And Dave competed for several years in the 1980s. He did the IFBB Pro World Championship, which later became the Arnold Classic. And he also did the Night of the Champions. So in part two of our interview today, we're going to talk about that MPC USA and the World Games victory that allowed Dave to turn pro. And we'll also talk about the professional contest he did. So it's going to be a really good interview with David Hawk. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember him from when he competed. What else is going on, guys? Oh, I got some old magazines. My parents are in town from Chicago, and I have all my old magazines at their house in their crawl space in the basement. So every time either I go over there or they come over here, they pack a little suitcase as much weight as will fit on the airplane, and they pack it with magazines. So my mom just grabbed a bunch. She didn't know what she was grabbing, but it turned out she did a fantastic job because she got some old muscle and fitness magazines. And she got the old Iron Man from Perry Rader, the ones right before they switched over to the John Balick magazines. And then she's got about, probably about 8 or 10 old, the first John Balick magazines that started in 1987. Lee Haney was on the cover of the first one, and it was right after the 1986 Mr. Olympia. So it had the 1986 Mr. Olympia contest coverage in there. Roger Schwab wrote the article. And wow, man, just some great stuff. I bet I haven't seen these magazines in years, probably 20 years. Just some unbelievable pictures, unbelievable articles. So today I am going to read, after our interview with David Hawk, I'm going to read from the February 1982 issue of Muscle and Fitness. And it is the Mr. Olympia report from 1981 that Rick Wayne wrote. And this is a two-part article. So I'm going to read you part one this week, and I'll read part two next week. And you guys are going to love this stuff. There is so much great stuff to share with you guys from these magazines. It's unbelievable. I really love looking through these old magazines. It makes me realize what got me excited about to be bodybuilding in the first place. You know, I feel like a little kid looking at these magazines again. It's unbelievable. All right. What else? So I got my seminar coming up, and it is going to be April 2nd and April 3rd. It's going to be in Spencer, Massachusetts. So if any of you guys are in the Massachusetts area and you want to attend, it's going to be very cheap. It's only $50 per day, and it's going to be a two-day seminar. So the first day, we're going to be doing like hands-on training in the morning. And then the second part of the seminar will be a lecture. It'll be 3 hours each, 3 hours with the training and then 3 hours with the lecture, where I'll talk about training and nutrition and how to structure a workout routine, things like that. And it'll be Saturday and Sunday, April 2nd and April 3rd. So if you are in the area, please come by and check it out. It'll be worth it. So Spencer, Massachusetts. I've never been out there before. I've never been to Boston either. So it should be fun. Thanks to Bruce, who is the gym owner. The name of the gym is Guaranteed Fitness Center. And he has been owning this gym for like 40 years. He is about my age, old school bodybuilder. I could tell from talking to him on the phone. And he's had a lot of bodybuilders come in for seminars. He had Mike Mentzer come in right before he died. So yeah, he's got a lot of stories and a lot. So good for him. For we got a gym owner out there that loves old school bodybuilding and is willing to bring people in to do seminars. There's not too many people that will do that anymore. Thank you to Bruce for offering this to me, and I'm excited to go out there. So I'll be out there April 2nd and 3rd. Hopefully I can get to a lot more of those this year now. So now that I'm working for myself, it should be I got a much clearer schedule. All right, I did get some emails from last week. Our old friend Scott Barron. Now, Scott was one of the first people to sign up as a Patreon donor. He contributed, I think he was contributing like $20 a month or something. It was like the maximum amount. So Scott has really, really supported the show over the last 4 years. And unfortunately, he's going to be leaving us, but he sent me an email and he said, "Hey, John, it's been an absolute honor to have been able to support your channel for the past several years. Your work is truly awesome. My interests have taken a different direction and I'm no longer following bodybuilding as my time and resources are extremely limited, especially with having a family. I want to wish you the very best and continued success. Sincerely, Scott Barron." So Scott, thank you so much for all your support. Scott is from the Chicago area like me. And I know he had some, he had a heart issue. He had the same kind of valve replacement that Arnold had to go through. And I think he just recently had to go through it again, but he came out okay. And yeah, he's got a lovely wife and daughter. I see him on Facebook all the time. So thanks, Scott, for all your support of the show, man. You've been the first guy there and you really, really gave unselfishly all these years. So thank you very much. Also got an email from Matt, and Matt said, "Hey, John, I hope you're keeping well. I wanted to wish you a very happy birthday for yesterday." He sent this last week. "Sounds like you had a great time at the restaurant with some good food as a treat." All right. Thank you, Matt. Yes, it was fun having my birthday last week. And like I said, my parents and my brother are coming into town this week. So we're going to celebrate again a week later. Oh, I wanted to wish Pat Comer a happy birthday. Pat is one of our big contributors to the podcast. Every time I do an interview, Pat is always there to send me old articles from some of the magazines. I think he's got some older magazines than I do. And he always sends me a lot of great pictures, especially some of those older ones that I'm looking for when I put the interviews on video for my YouTube channel. I know he just sent me a lot of like those Chris Dickerson pictures from when Chris was winning the AAU Mr. USA and AAU Mr. America. Some great, great shots of Chris and Boyer Coe. I still have that video up on YouTube as well. But thanks, Pat, and happy birthday. His birthday was like a couple days after mine. All right. I think that's all I got, guys. So without any further ado, here is our interview with David Hawk. This is part two of our interview, and Dave is going to talk about winning the MPC USA and the World Games, and he's also going to talk about his pro career. Here we go. Let's talk about 83, the Junior Nationals, and you won the light heavyweight class. Mm-hmm. And Rich Gaspari won the overall, and you guys were both about 20, 21 years old. I mean, I think Rich was 20. You were like 20, 21, right?
Yep. Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was a little.
So bit. How did you feel winning the light heavyweight class? There was some good guys in that. Rick Priscelli.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, I came in looking good. It was the first. You know, I mean, Bob Gruskin, you know, helped me out and tried to down me in for that show.
Okay.
And it was kind of crazy because I didn't, you know, I was married at the time and my parents hadn't seen me, you know, for like 6 weeks because, mm-hmm. you know, I was busy with my family and my wife. Well, I ended up, you know, I was sitting in the audience, you know, like early in the show and, you know, waiting for my parents to come. They went right by me. They didn't even recognize me because I had changed and I was so drawn, like my face. Yeah. Everything yeah. was so drawn and like they go, "Oh, my God, I didn't even know that was you." And then plus at that time, you know, I always kind of liked the blonde hair. And so at that time, I think I was even bleached at the
right. Right.
You know, because I felt like I was like David, you know, the David and Goliath wear long hair. Unlike everybody's has a shaved head or bald today. Where
I know we all had hair back in the '80s, right?
Yeah, like we all. Yeah, I thought that was like a symbol of
we had good hair in the '80s.
Yeah, exactly. So, but competing against Rich, it was really nice that. You know, I won the light heavyweights. I mean, it was a strong class, but you know, I think, you know, my overall symmetry, sharpness, hardness, I think, you know, it was a deserved win. And, when I competed in the overall, you know, Rich's legs were, there you go again, Rich's legs were a little bit sharper than mine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it could have gone either way, you know, cause there were parts on me that were a little sharper than his, I remember, but he was the first guy to ever like nudge me on the stage, like,
oh, did he?
like a bully.
Yeah.
It's like, I kind of shoved him back a little bit, but now Rich and I have been great friends, and you know, and we that was you know kind of the first time we really met.
And that was the first time you met. Okay.
Yeah, that was the first time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. First time we met, and like, I have a really great picture of him and I outside that show where we were shaking hands. And you talk about hair. He and I had great hair.
Right.
Yeah. It looked like we were wearing wigs.
Yeah.
You know?
Were you aware of Rich back then? Because he was from New Jersey and he was doing pretty good in the teenage shows.
Yeah. I was aware of him, but I didn't, realize, how good he was until I actually saw him. I didn't see, because you have to remember those magazines. If you think about it, I have one here. If you remember this, remember this.
There you go. Muscle up. That? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you think about it, you got to remember photos at that time. They were like black and white. You couldn't tell how people truly looked because it was just black and white. And,
right, that's true. Yeah.
You could see that they were good, but you couldn't judge them about like a perception of how big they are. What are they?
Yeah, right, how refined and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I enjoyed competing against him. And, there were judges that did say, I did have you first and then I put you second. And I was like, well, that's nice. Tell me after the show that, right. Hey, Rich won and he looked great and he deserved it. And, and he's had a great career and I consider him a very good friend. And, Rich inspires me, he's, mm-hmm. he's such a driven individual and, he and I just talk about, just normal life things nowadays. He's one of the guys that I'm really glad that I got to know. And, just like you, John, there's a lot of good people in this sport, even though we're all trying to achieve very similar goals and, we'd all like to be the winners, but, at least, the people that do win or beat you are good people and you can feel good about them winning.
I'm sure he was a little bit more aggressive in those days, being a young 20-year-old,
Well, he wanted
Rich has calmed down a little bit now.
He wanted to push me off the stage. I remember us getting into a little, pushing battle, posing down and things. But it was fun. I mean, I'll tell you, his physique, like when he was training with Haney and trying to beat Lee Haney, because I remember meeting Lee Haney for the first time.
Yeah.
Hey, Dave, man, you look like Lee is such a, he goes, you're really big. He goes, he came to Pittsburgh to pose at Jimmy Mannion's and, but Rich was training with him at the time. And there again, there's another good Christian, super guy that everybody just loves to death. And I love him. And, they're just good people. But I'll tell you, when Rich trained for that Olympia against him and his posing routine and everything.
Yeah.
He was on target. He was so hard. His veins looked like big straps coming out everywhere. And I'm thinking, wow, it's impressive. He was right there. Yeah. That's the thing. It's like, how do you compete against Lee Haney that has such great framework and structure and height? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Rich, though he was just as good, he can't take away that the more narrow shoulders, the more stocky build. Yeah. And though he deserved every bit as much to win that show because of how good he looked, it's just, when you're talking about, again, that's genetics. It's like very hard to beat somebody like Lee Haney who really, had a better physique than Arnold. I mean, everybody puts Arnold like, I think Arnold's upper body was great, and he like Arnold was, very good in a lot of ways, and like he had the separations, the symmetry and lots of good things. But, when it really comes down to it, if you look at, the Mr. Olympias, Samir Banu and Haney, and even though Dorian was great, I like the guy, and you look at Frank Zane. I like the guys who had the flowing, symmetry. you know, like everything looked proportionable and, you know, kind of all, it all met, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
okay.
It's just me personally, but
yeah.
So
the next year, now you win your class at the Junior Nationals. So the next year you go to the USA. What was the decision to do the USA instead of the Nationals, or that was just the first one that came along?
Yeah, it was just the timing of everything. You know, it was in San Jose. I got to meet Mike Christian there. I met Samir Padu for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's like, I was like, oh, here's a Mr. Olympia competitor. My arms are as big as his. But Samir, I'll tell you, Samir, I mean, when you see him in some photos, you think, why, you know, how he didn't win more Mr. Olympias than he did.
Yeah,
I mean, really, Samir has to be one of the most perfect professional bodybuilders, from posing to aesthetics, size, symmetry, good looks, you know, great hair.
Yeah.
I thought, man. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And, but again, you know, I went to San Jose and competed. I came in heavy in that show.
You did the heavyweight.
I thought, you know, I didn't want to go down to the light heavyweights, you know, because I started putting on some good muscle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought that from the way I saw some of the judging going, I thought they want hardness, but they also want size. And so I pushed that and ultimately, you know, Gary Striden was in my class, and he's a freak. He's a good guy. He's also a freak. There's another awesome, great, great bodybuilder. But again, like, even though Gary was good and won the class, I mean, his physique, you know, his shoulders and chest are big, but his back's a little on the side compared to some of the other guys. But then again, his legs were so incredible that, you know, you would overlook the back and, you know, just focus on his most musculars and things. And he drew the win that way. So, but he was a super competitor, but there were a lot of good guys in that class. But then that's where, you know, I think I took fourth in that year.
Yeah, Neil Spruce was third and John Lloyd was second. Remember John Lloyd? And then Gary was first.
So, but, and then, you know, that's where in 85, I decided to come back and compete as a light heavyweight. You know, I knew I had.
Why did you decide to go to light heavyweight, Dave? Was it because, well, like Rich, same thing, right? Because the year before he competed as a heavyweight and then he went down to light heavyweight and got the universe win.
Yeah. You have to remember, I used to train at Mannion's gym. That's where we all trained. I mean, even it's kind of crazy. When I trained at Mannion's gym, it used to take me 2 hours to get there.
You know, really? Wow, that far, huh?
Yeah. It was that far. I was at Pitt at the time, and also, just whether I was coming from home, I didn't have a vehicle, and, you know, my buddy and I would take buses. So we'd take this place and then would have to wait a half hour till the next bus came. So by the time it might have not been 2 hours, but it felt like 2 hours.
But it
was literally like an hour to get from one location to his gym, because, you know, would go from where we were at into Pittsburgh over to, you know, towards the Carnegie area, and then another bus. So it actually took us 3 bus rides to get to the gym, and then, you know, 3 bus rides back home. But we were dedicated and we did it at the time. And then thank God my parents gave me a car, and that changed the thing, you know, because they realized I was taking a lot of bus rides that they thought, maybe we should give them the car. So, Jimmy was very influential, you know, in my career, and, keeping me inspired and pushing me along. And, when you have good, you know, quality people who, you know, just tell you the truth and say, hey, you know, some people, you know, like, you can be, you know, we all have it, you know, we can all feel we look good and do certain things. And then you pose for somebody and then they go, well, you need this and you need, and you almost take it like, how can you even say that to me? Because you know how hard you've trained to get to look this way.
Yeah.
But then they are honest and they said, listen, the only way you're going to do well is if you get to around this weight and you can display that level of hardness and you know, muscularity, you know, to win the show. And so I, you know, I took that in, and when I came out for the USA, I was pretty sharp. And the thing was that I knew Matt Mendenhall, God bless him. We've lost a lot of good people.
Oh, we lost a lot of people just last year alone. Yeah.
And Matt Mendenhall, super good looking guy, just aesthetic.
Yeah.
Physique.
Phenomenal.
I was like, I kind of like to imagine I was his, like his mini, a little mini twin.
Right. Because it looked like,
But no, that's the thing. I trained against. I kept him in my mind and kept looking and thought, how I can beat him is if I'm tighter than him. The only way I'm going to beat this guy is if I come in sharper and harder, because even though I may not be as heavy or, you know, and I said, I can remember back to those days. I knew that I needed to be as tight as possible, maintain as much muscle as possible, but the illusion on stage, I will look, if I come in harder, I will look better than him, you know, because it's, you know, that's the thing. You get caught up in this. You have to have a certain weight that you need to be on that stage. Yeah. And the problem with having that weight number in your head is that you don't come in as good. I mean, look at this. I mean, I tied with Bertel Fox at the Night of Champions, and though that was kind of a weird win at that time, because that was one of the shows that they said they were actually testing. And so I came in completely clean.
Oh, did you really?
Oh, yeah. It's like, and you're not testing these guys.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, oh, my stupid. Like, yeah, so, but anyways, you know, it's the thing that, you know, I could stand next to a guy who's literally 15, 20 pounds heavier than me, and I can match up, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, just because of my frame and the way things look, my muscle bellies might be a little leaner or smaller, but, you know, it's all an illusion up there.
Yeah.
And you know, coming in as a light heavyweight really helped me
what was the weight difference, Dave, between 94 and 95 or 85?
I competed in the USA as a heavyweight, I was probably about 217, 218.
Okay.
And, naturally, you know, I was 20 pounds lighter, light heavy. Yeah. It was hard to get down. Like once I had put that muscle on and, you know, and again, you have to remember, even when you have muscle, you know, the more muscle you have, the more water your body can hold as well. You know, I mean, just, you know, naturally your body's going to, and then, well, the problem is the water's in the muscle, and if it spills out, then you're screwed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, right.
You know, 'cause then you flatten out a bit.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, I was about 218, you know, at that time. And then in 85, I was just made light heavyweights. And then when I went to the World Games, you know, I really dieted down. Here was a weird thing. We went over like, almost like 5 days early before.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. Because weigh-ins were early.
Okay. Well,
actually, I weighed in at, London, you know, Steve did his thing by nailing my feet to the wall. And then, you know, we got weighed in and got all done. And, you know, I made the 198. And then by the time I competed, I was 208.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. And I was staying on my diet, but I was eating more calories that whole entire time, because I felt like that whole time I was like burning up. Cause Steve was pushing me to do more cardio. You know, he was just, you know, being a good friend and, you know, and training, you know, while I was there and posing, and I just kept feeling like I was flattening out. And then I ended up eating and carbing up for 4 days before the show. And again, you know, but with, you know, managing my water, but, you know, doing it, not, you know, not splurging, not like you splurge after a show.
But
because of the increased calories and because my body was so depleted, you know, I came in and it was in the light heavyweight class at 207 or 208 that day.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the reaction from the bodybuilding media and the judges and everything after that? Cause that was, you know, that was a huge win for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the USA or the Worlds?
The Worlds.
The Worlds. No, it was, everybody thought that, you know, that they saw the potential of me competing on the Olympia stage.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you know, that's when, you know, Joe Weider had asked me to come out to do a photo shoot, you know, and that was like kind of my real first photo shoot.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so, but then Joe wanted me to actually move out there and, he said, Dave, you know, in his voice, come on, Dave, you got to come out here. He goes, yeah, I'll get you set up and you can train with the guys. And like, okay. And then actually I asked Jimmy Mannion about it. And Jim goes, you're not moving to California.
Huh.
Jim said, Dave, he goes, why would you do that? And I'm here. Well, don't you think it would help? And he goes, no, he goes, build yourself up, keep doing what you're doing. And he goes, eventually you can go to California. He goes, you got your family back here. And
yeah,
you know, he said, you taken your whole, he said, if it was just you, I'd say go.
Yeah.
If he goes,
married and you got kids.
He goes, yeah. Married and kids. He goes, listen, he goes, that lifestyle out there is not for you. And he goes, I'm saying it more as like a father figure.
Yeah.
And then just being your friend. He said, yeah. You know, he goes, you know, because he looked at me like JM. He's, you know, because yeah. I was the same age as JM. JM and I actually went to Pitt together and we've been friends for many, many years and they're family to me.
Yeah.
He really kind of, you know, who would have known if I would have went out to California? Maybe something big would have happened. But, you know, I chose to, you know, follow and not go. Not that that was a bad decision. I'm just saying, you know, Jimmy felt that I, you know, because of my, you know, with my wife and kids and things, he said, you know, what, just stay here. You're going to progress. You're going to do good. Just keep, you know, staying focused. So,
well, we've all heard stories about guys that went out there and it did kind of mess them up, you know, because it is a fast lifestyle out there. So it was probably good advice from Jim.
It is good advice. In the long run, I couldn't be more happier with my life that I have.
Right.
You know, I mean, actually, you know, I'm very dedicated. I'm still in the industry. You know, I work behind the scenes on a lot of stuff. You know, I mean, I used to be out there in the front, you know, in those earlier days, but I'm still involved in the sport. And ultimately, it's one of those things where I still work within the nutritional industry, you know, in developing innovation nutrition that actually comes out within the supplement industry.
Yeah.
So I'm still involved in that part of the business. And in that's you know, I was able to take the bodybuilding and turn it into a business.
Yeah. That's great.
Bodybuilding helped put me in the right place to, you know, I know all the ingredient manufacturers, I know all the retailers, I know the buyers, I know it, like it's a full circle of the group that I have associated with. And so I was able to take what is needed from bodybuilding, fitness, weight training, sports performance, and build that into a career. So even though I don't compete, you know, I still live the lifestyle and am in the industry of this sport. And that's great because everybody can't be number one in it.
Yeah.
There's always going to be somebody better than you.
How long have you been involved with that, Dave?
Oh, 30 years. Yeah.
30 years. Wow.
Yeah. Actually. So believe it or not, you know, John, I'm actually, you know, I do consulting work with a few different companies and I have a company called Super Brewed. Actually, here's the thing. You know, chicken, you know, I used to eat 40 pounds of chicken a week. I even built a snack line. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen that chicken snack line out there. This is a chicken breast in a bag. You know,
it's called
Physically Fit. Well, anyways, chicken is becoming like obsolete. Actually, there's things happening in our industry and nowadays due to the pandemic and bird flu and other things, you know, chicken is, you know, look at the price of chicken when you go to, you know, get a chicken breast.
Right.
I mean, chicken is a great source of protein, but it's becoming limited.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, and with the population growth, and certain things. I mean, and you got to remember, more people are eating healthier, So that means the more people that aren't eating McDonald's are eating the chicken that you or other fitness people would want.
Right.
So it limits what's out there. And then, you know, you've got big business that takes advantage of that, and they're going to charge you more. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got gas prices going up like crazy.
Yeah.
So, but uniquely enough, you know, I try to stay ahead of the curve on protein innovation. I actually launched the first chicken protein isolate and powders into the market, and broth is still big, but chicken meat protein is becoming very difficult to get. And there are challenges with it. And actually, you know, we are trying to be more sustainable. And actually, there's a guy named Brian Tracy, who's a food scientist who has developed a unique fermented bacterial cultured protein. So actually, you know, he was able to develop, and this is like a whole patented process. You look at an elephant and you look at gorillas and you say, well, how can these animals maintain so much muscle and so much strength? And all they eat are bark and plants.
Yeah,
they're not eating meat. I mean, right. Some gorillas get meat here and there, but that's not what they eat. The right. point is that their guts are made to convert fiber and starch into protein. So it actually, their bodies are built to where their gut flora breaks down and kind of ferments all that fiber and all that starch that they're eating, you know, from plants, mm-hmm. and converts it into complete protein.
Hmm.
So Brian Tracy was able to take, and it's called Super Brewed Foods, not a super fancy website, but it's the science behind the technology. And it's a sustainable cultured protein that literally he was able to take and almost in some ways through fermentation, create what happens in a guts of a gorilla and convert fiber and starch and sugars into a whole complete food protein source. So imagine it. Yeah. So in it actually it's grown. It's like it's a form of bacterial protein, but it's a healthy bacteria that, you know, you think about penicillin, think about how it grows on bread. But you know, when it's, you know, analyzed and how it works in the body, it's an antibiotic, you know what I mean? Yeah. It works, that's kind of a similar process that, you know, these fiber and starches, and I may not be explaining it completely right, but people will learn about it soon, but they can actually take fiber and starch and grow a whole complete food protein source, complete with amino acids. The BCAAs are 2 to 2 to 2. We're so used to 1 to 1 to 1 on BCA because that's what whey protein has in it. You know, that's what some other proteins,
right.
but you know, all of them, you know, whether it's leucine, isoleucine or valine, they actually should be equal. There's really no study that says, oh, this should be 2 to 1 to 1.
Right.
It's just, that's how it turned out in whey protein. The point is that, you know, whether you're taking, you know, leucine is the most important, but isoleucine and valine are just as important. So what's unique is this has a 2 to 2 to 2 BCA component. So it's higher than whey protein. It's actually also has all your essential, 9 essential amino acids. It also has, aspartic acid. You know, mm-hmm. did you know that aspartic acid, when you take aspartic acid, it actually stimulates the brain and luteinizing hormones, so you produce more testosterone. So it actually is higher in aspartic acid. So not only does it have your standard amino acids, but also, you know, your essentials. And you'll get, like, if you think about it, so like most protein shakes, you know, it takes like a 16 ounce to get in 33 grams of protein.
Yeah.
Well, you can have an 8 ounce of this concentrated cultured protein and get in the same 32 grams of protein.
Mm.
I mean, it's like a less mass protein, more concentrated protein. And uniquely enough, in this protein and how this happens, I'm still trying to understand it myself. It has vitamins, minerals, and a full dose of vitamin D. So where whey protein, pea protein, rice protein, soy protein are great protein sources, there's no vitamin nutrition unless you add it to it.
Right.
This actually takes in the cultured, you know, fermented process actually grows the vitamin nutrition from the, you know, from this, these byproducts, and it becomes a whole complete food protein. So it's protein and vitamins and minerals.
Wow. That's amazing.
And it's sustainable. I mean, that's, I mean, so I think it's going to be incredibly great for our industry, especially with people, you know, just any dieter to general health. I mean, when you're looking for protein, I mean, just think about it. You know, the world's kind of in a crazy place.
Yeah.
It's hard to get eggs, hard to get meat, hard to get milk, hard to get chicken, hard to get even plant protein. You know, things are happening.
Yeah.
Well, here we're able to get a restorable source through fiber and starches and sugar and grow protein. So imagine that.
I mean,
it's amazing. So, I mean, and there's more to come. So, I mean, I didn't give you the full details on that, but
your company is doing all this too.
A company that I'm working with. Yes. And it's all brand new science, new innovation. And that's the thing, when you know, we're looking at sustainable cars and sustainable this sustainable food sources. Well, that's the thing. There's a lot of people to feed.
Yeah.
And you can give them a food protein source that you can literally grow, almost like, you know, how, you know, it's kind of like when you make beer, you know how when you make beer and, you know, you ferment things, you know, well, it's the same thing. Or, you know, it's kind of like when you make cheese, you know, they take, you know, the byproduct of cheese when they're making cheese that turns into whey protein.
Right.
Ultimately, here's a new non-dairy, non-plant, all organic, natural food source protein, you know, that is, you know, going to be really exciting. You know, I don't know if you, and I can't even think of the, but Matt Damon was in a movie where he was on Mars and he actually had to survive.
Yeah.
And on Mars, this is kind of like, this is what they could be doing. You know, like you could be on a planet, and long as you had this fiber and starch or these byproducts, you could literally, you know, ferment it and turn it into a protein source. So,
I remember him doing that in the movie.
Exactly. So, well, anyways.
Yeah. I just listened to a podcast last week and they were talking about how food supply is going to become limited and we're going to run it. And they were actually suggesting on the podcast that you should make friends with a farmer if you want to make sure you're going to be able to get protein in the future.
Exactly. Yeah. There's, I mean, there's been a big cultural shift, you know,
a lot of stuff,
you know, and I think back, you know, I hate to say it. I remember, you know, Arnold going from a meat eater to this high plant protein
vegan. Yeah.
Vegan, you know, and, but at the same time, you know, it's like, there are things that, you know, we just have to, hey, we got to just be trying to pay attention and, you know, but at the same time you need protein and, you know, hopefully this is going to be a new viable source for bodybuilders, fitness people, dieters, just anybody. And the really cool thing is it's, you know, it's all natural, you know, all organic. And at the same time, you know, there's no allergen. It's allergen free. It's completely allergen free. And the big thing is, you know, when you test it, it's, complete like whey, complete like, you know, other sustainable proteins, but but it also gives you your vitamins, minerals, and a lot more.
So, yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah. So, but
well, let's finish up by talking about your pro career, Dave. You got your pro card after that World Games. So that was cool too, that you did the USA on the same year they had the World Games, because people that don't remember, they used to have the World Games every 4 years, kind of like the Olympics.
Right.
And the World Games was for sports that were not in the Olympics, but were like being considered, I guess, to be in the Olympics. And
exactly.
And back in the 80s, bodybuilding was one of those sports. So every 4 years, if you won the World Games, it was kind of like winning. It was the same thing as winning the Mr. Universe, where you could get your pro card because you were beating the best amateurs in the world. So you go into the USA the same year they have the World Games. So you were able to win your class at the World Games. Unfortunately, Matt Mendenhall didn't, and then he never got his pro card.
Right.
Because he lost to Barry DeMay that year.
Yeah.
So you get your pro card. So what's the plan now for 86? You did the World Pro Championships, right? Which became the Arnold later on.
Yep, exactly. So I got invited to the Pro World, which now is the Arnold, and I placed fourth there. I mean, that's – I think Lee Labrada won it that year, right?
No, Rich won. And
Rich won. That's right. Yeah. Actually, no, I'd always think that's right. Labrada beat me in the Night of Champions. That's right.
Right. Yeah.
There's another great guy and great physique.
Yeah.
Still going strong. But yeah, that's right. Rich won that year. That was he looked phenomenal. But it was great to be in, you know, in on the stage again with him and others.
How did you feel doing your first pro show?
I felt great. I kind of got a little scared. So I came in a little bigger in that show.
Okay.
So yeah, because I ended up competing, you know, even though there aren't any weight classes, you know, I was a heavyweight. I competed at 212 that year. And it was one of those things where, but I was still hard and still tight, you know, I mean, probably could have been a little bit sharper. But it was a great experience. I mean, I enjoyed being there and, but you know, it's like anything else, you know, I wish I could get rid of those nervous jitters that you get when you go there. Like you're all set mentally, physically, and then you go and you look at everybody and then you go, oh man. You start questioning yourself.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, it was your first pro show too, though. So
yeah, exactly. But, you know, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, it was nice. And then, you know, I mean, compared to an amateur show, you know, you're treated better. I mean, there has a nice pump up room. There's places to, you know, oil up and, you know, prep, and you're able to have, a coach or assistant or somebody help you. So it was good.
And that was on TV too. It was on ESPN.
They were actually given the sport some coverage then.
Right. That was a great contest. Yeah. I thought Rich looked the best he ever looked in his life.
Oh, yeah.
God, he was amazing at that contest.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, I'm sorry. Hold on.
That's okay.
I don't know what I am. I just turned that off. I hate that when my phone rings. It pulls up on my computer.
Yeah, I can't get mine to stop doing that either.
Yeah, so I forgot. Well, you know, it being a Sunday, I wasn't even thinking that was going to happen today.
Right.
So, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
So then you did the Night of the Champions a couple months later. And that, like you said, that was one Lee Labrada won. And that was
exactly. Yeah. So crazy enough, you know, you talk about the Night of Champions. So I came actually into the Night of Champions, all set to do well in that show. And I still took fourth, you know, I was happy with it. Maybe it wasn't that Night of Champions. Maybe it was the second Night of Champions. I just remember you're going to remember it's been so many years, these events, you know, but I remember competing against John Natashak and lots of good competitors at that show.
I think that was 87.
Yeah. What was the other guy's name from the UK that was in there? God.
Oh, Frank Richard.
Yeah. Frank Richards. Yeah. He looked great. I mean, then Scott Wilson.
Yeah.
Lots of good guys. Well, I remember being at one of the Night of Champions, whether it was that year or the following year. And, you know, Wayne D'Amelio was, I guess, running those shows.
Yeah, he was running
them. And Bill Katz was actually judging one. And a year that I don't know if it was that year or not, but you talk about a funny story. I just remember Bill Katz coming. I pulled out of the driveway after.
You mean Mike Katz, Dave?
Yeah, Mike Katz. Sorry. Yeah, Mike Katz. So, damn, 60s hitting me hard. Mike Katz. Yeah. So Mike's a super good guy. But Mike is, he kind of, like, I was leaving after pre-judging. It was like a really long, like the judging seemed to go on forever.
Okay. You know,
years ago. Like, I mean, today, nowadays, they're like, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah,
boom.
They get done. Yeah.
Yeah, they get. Yeah. And here I was, you know, for 2.5 hours posing on stage. And Mike Katz goes to me, oh, my God, Dave, dude, you look really good. I'm here. Well, I just competed. He goes, oh, and he was judging the show.
Do you remember seeing it?
Yeah. I have no idea. And I was like, and then he comes back. He goes, I am so sorry, Dave. He was having probably a brain fart like I was just now, you know, calling them Bill Cats, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
And he comes back. He goes, oh, my God, Dave. He goes, I'm really sorry because I saw you up there. And he goes, because the thing was, he goes, you look so different in your car, you know, and he goes, and it just, you know, he goes, I just wanted to say hi. And I wasn't expecting, you know, he goes,
yeah.
Anyway, so it was just a funny thing. And I'm thinking, okay, well, we're both losing it now, but no, he did come back and he goes, oh, by the way, he goes, you placed. And so maybe it was that year, but that's kind of a funny story. Cause he, you know, I mean, those judges are looking at lots of guys.
Oh yeah. Sometimes, yeah.
You know, and I mean, there were very large lineups at those shows.
Oh yeah. The Night of Champions was huge.
Oh yeah.
So many guys.
Exactly. I mean, Wayne DeMail used to do a great job. I mean, that was, he made the show feel like a show.
Right. Right.
And so, it was a lot of fun.
What do you think of Lee Labrada in that show? That was his first show or first pro.
Yeah, no, Lee, I mean, you know, he was kind of like, a fuller Frank Zane, you know, aesthetically, he had everything going for him. He had a well-deserved win there, you know.
That was a show also where Barry DeMay didn't make the top five, right? And the crowd was booing and stuff.
Probably because I beat him.
Yeah, right. You got fifth.
Yeah. Barry should have beat Hawk. When I think about those days, you know, because Barry's still around. There's a lot of good guys that are still around and, you know, actually, you know, coming back. Like, you know, you look at Roy Littemeyer and some of them that, still have, like, you know, they're tipping 60 or are 60. You know what I mean? And I always think, you know, wouldn't it be kind of cool to get the same old group of guys back together? Like even you, like, hey, let's all get ready for the show and let's kind of repeat this show and see what it's like.
Don't kill
yourself, but let's do it. And let's get people to join in and watch us on YouTube or somewhere.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, because, I mean, actually, I think people would – I think, you know, just like the Masters, I mean, it's great to see new Masters, but I do think that, you know, I do think that there is a very large audience that was really impacted by our sport from to, you know, to the late 90s that would, like, go, wow, I'd pay for that. You know what I mean? I'd love to see these. Can you get these guys back? And, I mean, it'd be nice if there was, like, kind of money in it. It would make sense that it could pull it off. But it's a nice dream. But it's because John, like even though you aren't competing or do it, you still have it in your blood. You still
still buying.
You know, every time you touch the weight or pose, you feel like I could do that again.
Right. that's why I started this podcast, because there's still an audience for that golden age, the 70s
exactly.
and 80s. And, you know, people still love hearing about it.
Yeah, and it's great that I love when people from that era can still appreciate it. And I mean I don't like to hear them condemn the younger guys too much. I mean, that's kind of the sport has kind of pushed them that way. I mean, I'll tell you, I wish they could dial it back a little bit, mm-hmm. I mean, not with board shorts, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, but just dial it back a little bit to, try to, keep people safer. And then,
I was thinking about that too. Like, how do you go backwards? You know, I mean, I don't know if the fans would accept, smaller guys, but.
I think it's, John, I think, I think, and they've tried to do it with that, 210 pound class, but I think really the idea is that if they could bring more showmanship to it and make it more entertaining, even though nobody wanted to see Vince McMahon, take over the IFBB or things of that sort back then, the concept was right. Concept of the show, the concept of, I mean, look at this. I've worked with Kurt Angle, since 1996, mm-hmm. when he won the Olympic gold medal. Mm-hmm. I mean, good friend of mine, the best wrestler on the planet, but then got into sports entertainment and was the best professional wrestler, as well. Like, I mean, he, you know, not he could act, he could entertain. His character was what it was. You know, it's kind of what Vince molded the character,
right,
angle to be. But when it came to the talent, it was his talent in the ring. He had the athletic ability, and they've got millions. They've got 60 million fans worldwide that dial in to watch it. I mean, imagine if we could be doing that with bodybuilding, where not that you're trying to make it a spectacle and you still, you know, but it, the problem is that our industry is letting social media run who is a good, who's the best bodybuilders or the best fitness people. And it's really, you know, it really needs a governing body. I mean, we have one out there, you know, with the NPC and the IFBB. It's just why aren't they taking, you know, and transforming the sport into a little bit more entertainment and trying to figure out how that works.
You know, it's not always talk about how the posing needs to improve, but it just doesn't seem like people aren't, I mean, there are some good posers now, but I think overall it needs a lot more. People need to be better posers.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And then there needs to be better criteria to posing, like how you do poses, and that it's not just the standard mandatory poses. Maybe you need to be able to show that you can bend down or get up or do certain things, you know, that make it, you know, that make it a bit more entertaining. So, I mean, show the more athletic side of the athlete. So it's just not how big and hard you are, but there is some athletic component to it. You know?
So after you did that Night of the Champions in 87, Dave, you didn't compete for a few years, right? Until 91.
So what happened was I was getting ready for the Mr. Olympia, and actually, I went over to London to do a, you know, I was going to London, Scotland, and a couple other areas that where we were doing kind of meet and greets. And, and what had happened was I went over there, you know, and I was probably about, you know, 240, 250 at the time. And they had me staying at various people's homes. So there's like, you know, I can't remember their names back then, but there's one place I stayed and they said, hey, don't use the towels. My husband has shingles. And okay, that's cool. You know, but they had me staying at various, you know, good people from the area. Just, hey, do you mind if, you know, there's no hotel here, could we have Dave Hart stay a night because we got this, you know, got him going to this gym to do a seminar and blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
So somewhere along that travel, I picked up E. coli. And, you know, and whether it was from the food or something, but I ended up towards the end of my, you know, because I stayed there for a couple of weeks, I ended up, like, I first got a cold, and then the cold seemed to like turn, like felt like it was turning into pneumonia. Next thing, the whole side of my head was swelling out. Like I, you know, and I woke up the next day, I was supposed to fly out, and I woke up in the hotel, and my wife, actually my wife flew in because I went for 2 weeks. She came for a week. Well, we were getting ready to head back. Well, that the morning, the night before the morning, we're supposed to go back. I got up and I went to the bathroom and I passed out and put my head through a porcelain tub. So this bacteria got into my brain and is actually, was actually causing me to convulse. And then the promoters over there said, you know what? They said, don't go to the hospitals here because you won't come out. Or, you know, like they just, they didn't feel very good about me going to their hospitals. They said, you know what, we'll just cut it. Let's get you flown back. I, thank God I flew back. Well, the next morning, you know, because of the travel time, came back. I ended up passing out in my house and ended up in the hospital. And I was, I had this bacteria in my blood put me on tons of antibiotics and all this other stuff. And that's when the stories came out years ago. They go, oh, Dave Hawk has liver cancer and blood. Yeah, I don't know if you remember, there was, you know, some rumors back then, but actually that, because I got so sick at that time, it really kind of, and I actually, well, what they had to do is they got the back, they got the bacteria under control. Like I said, it's like a form of E. coli.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to blame it on the steroids. It wasn't, I had no health issues from the steroids that I had taken at the time. And, you know, cause I was always under medical supervision and try to do things right. And so I didn't think that would be the issue. But like right. I said, so I had this bacteria and that it was getting into my brain, but that they couldn't understand what was creating the convulsions. But you can imagine, you know, bodybuilders at that time, you know, they're going to, a rumor gets out.
Yeah, the rumor
hospital, people are going to see you dying. And, you know, so I had to have some magazine retractions done, which they did. But it was a scary time. And so ultimately it made me rethink things, you know, like, wow, you know, man, I was really sick. So yeah. The thing I did have to do is I had to get operated on. They took my tonsils out because it had my whole neck infected because my neck was swollen. Side of my head was swollen and they had to get it out of my tonsils. So, and, you know, you got to remember it. I think I was like 25, 26, maybe 27 at the time, but you know, I ended up, you can't eat for weeks after you get your tonsils out just trying to get back to health, lost a lot of weight and trying to come back from, you know, between that 87, you know, to, you know, 90 timeframe. I had a real mental challenge because, you know, I thought, wow, you know, I could be here today and gone tomorrow. That was kind of a scary thing. And so, you know, but I did come back and, you know, I competed again, but, you know, it was just, I got very sick over in London and, you know, that was like almost like a COVID experience.
Yeah.
Wow. Like I didn't know if I was going to make it.
Yeah,
exactly. That's the whole point. But actually the doctor said, no, you're healthy, strong. All your blood stuff's good. He said, we got to heavily antibiotic you. And, you know, so they had me on, you know, tons of antibiotics, IV antibiotics to IV drips, just to, you know, put my nutrition in me and stuff. I got better, but they said, man, your tonsils have so much bacteria in them. They said, we gotta take those out and scrape your throat. And after I had that surgery done, I literally couldn't eat for 8 weeks. It was like, it was like a Jell-O diet, Jell-O and ice cream. You know, not necessarily good for bodybuilding.
Not good for building muscle.
Yeah. So
how was it when you came back, Dave, in the 90s?
When I came back and, realizing, you know, I've got two little kids and things, you know, it just, you know, I just wanted to be more sensible about what I did, but then I just kind of lost, you know, somewhere around that time, I lost a little passion of how hard I'm going to push my health, because here I am, I went over there healthy, but you know, I was all bulked up and, you know, naturally, you know, I'm like, I'm heavy, you know, even though I tried to stay in some decent shape. But yeah, it was really one of those things where, you know, when I came back and lost so much weight and looked at my kids, you know, it just changed my perspective of, you know, did I really want to continue down this road of bodybuilding, you know, having these two little ones that depend on me. And so
and you had already started your business and stuff at that time?
Yeah. So I was in the, you know, what's kind of, you know, I got into the publication side of the business, you know, so I was actually, you know, working with a group where we put out, a couple different magazines, Let's Live magazine and Muscle and Body for GNC. And basically we were, you know, talking about health and nutrition. And that's really where I maintained my focus, you know, why did I get into bodybuilding is because I wanted to be healthier, be stronger, and take care of myself. And like I said, you know, who knows what's going to get you, you know, it's like, it's not always, you know, the drugs that people think it is. There's other things out there that can get you as well. Many things.
And so,
But
then you came back and you did a couple of master shows, right?
Because it's still, I would love to come back now, John.
Get ready for the masters.
You know, 2023, you know, who knows, maybe somebody will call and say, hey, Dave, you need to do that.
Yeah. You're over 60.
I'm relatively healthy other than, you know, I've had reconstruction on both elbows, reconstruction on both knees.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be great just to go in lean and be in shape and just for the sheer passion of it. I think of guys like Albert Beckles and people who competed in their 60s. And I think, you know, well, I'd really like to do that, you know, but can I do it? That's another story. I mean, I don't know if I'm too banged up or hurt to do it, but I'm going to use that as some motivation right now, John, to get myself in the gym.
Yeah, good.
Even though I may not compete, I am going to try to.
Right. Just have that as a goal. Right.
And I think there's a little dream underline of something, you know?
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I tell you this, you know, I see, you know, I see Rich still pushing hard at the gym.
Yeah.
And, other guys, you know, that are just a little younger or same age as me and just like you, John.
Yeah.
You know, I've let these injuries and a little bit of depression hold me back from it. And so, you know, I'm feeling like my legs are getting back on track. Yeah. I'll tell you, when you can't walk up your steps and stuff, right.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Ronnie Coleman, super great guy.
I know.
Trained his ass off, but you know, it's like, when you become crippled a bit, you know, it's challenging mentally, you know what I mean? Because you just don't, you know, it's like you, literally, John, I can only do a leg extension with 30 pounds right now. Like I'm still trying to get my patellas and all my tie-ins to work right. But my leg extensions are literally 20 reps with 30 pounds.
Yeah.
And I feel it like the next day I'm like, wow, man.
They'll get back.
I mean it, you know, I had some serious injuries there, but you know, we'll see.
All right, Dave, well, we'll wrap it up here. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and talking about your career, and I've always looked up to you all these years, so it was great to finally reconnect with you and talk to you about everything.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully I can be doing an interview on you and we can talk
all right. about
you have done as a legend.
In all right. Thank you. Thank you.
Because you're still pushing. And here's the thing. Maybe it's time for you to get ready for the Masters Olympics.
Yeah. I just did a photo shoot in December right before Christmas. So I usually do that every couple of years just to see what I look like, you know, like, okay, what am I going to look like at 59? What am I going to look like at 56?
Yep. That's how you set goals. And hopefully, you know what I mean? Yeah, you're inspiring me and you're inspiring others. And
thanks, Dave.
I mean, that's what it's about. We have to help each other and keep ourselves motivated and not let ourselves fall into depression or let the world bring us down, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's still our passion. Like you said, we're always going to be bodybuilders, right?
Absolutely. We're bodybuilders in heart, men of steel.
Yeah. Are you going to the Arnold this year, Dave?
Actually, I was planning to go to the Arnold. We're waiting for our grass. We have to get our grass stuff on our Super Brood. It's coming.
Okay.
It's just, you know, anytime you go through the FDA and things like that, some things take longer. We were all set to go there to promote what we're doing. But this year I'm actually going to, since I don't have the business aspect of it, and then the teen challenge is on hold just because weren't getting quite the turnout of teens, you know, for the Arnold, just because I think people are still trying to adjust that things are opening up.
Yeah, I know. It'll be interesting to see what it's like this year.
Yeah. So I think this year is going to be okay for the Arnold. Next year we'll be back. And, you know, so I'll be back there next year and, so now this year I'm going to stay back here, and actually I'm going to go to the gym and try to work out and think about how I'm going to look for the Arnold in a couple of years.
Right. All right. Sounds good.
Well, thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Dave.
For having me on your program, buddy. And that you consider me a legend that you put me on here. So
absolutely. You deserve
it. That's awesome, brother. Thank you very much. Take care,
Dave. Take care, buddy.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to David Hawk for coming on the show and doing the interview. I've known Dave for 30 years, unbelievable, since that Teenage Mr. America contest we competed in. So thanks to Dave for coming on and sharing his experience of his long career in bodybuilding. I also want to thank our Patreon donors. You guys keep the show going. I appreciate your support very much. If anyone out there is interested in becoming a Patreon donor, just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and you'll see in the upper right-hand corner the link for Patreon. And I appreciate all you guys who contribute every week to the show. You keep the show going. And if anybody has any emails they want to send us, just send it to naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I'll read your email on the air. I always appreciate your feedback. Please do that. Love getting the emails. All right. So as I mentioned in the beginning of the show, I have this old article from the February 1982 issue of Muscle and Fitness Magazine from one of my favorite writers, Rick Wayne. And Rick was at the show. He was at the 81 Olympia. He was not at the 80 Olympia, but he was at the 81 Olympia. He wrote a long two-part article on the 81 Olympia. So I'm going to read part one today. And next week, when we have our interview, I will read part two. All right. It says, Olympia 81, there was more going on in Columbus than met the judge's eyes. Part one by Rick Wink. Barely 6 days before the 1981 Mr. Olympia contest, Arnold Schwarzenegger took time from a hectic promotional campaign for his latest book to dine with longtime English friends Wag and Diane Bennett, who were on a short visit to Los Angeles and Hawaii. Lately, Arnold had become very touchy about matters relating to his public image. If in the old days he had crowed foolishly to Playboy and Rolling Stone about his marijuana habit and other private idiosyncrasies, in recent months, he had done his best to compensate for his childish indiscretions. No more stories about how he caused an overzealous follower to anoint himself with axle grease. No more practical jokes at the expense of others. He had become the consummate politician, yearning to be everybody's Mr. Nice Guy. He had taken to preaching at ghetto gatherings and penitentiaries throughout the United States and aboard such Navy ships as the aircraft carrier USS Nassau. And the message he preached was strictly according to the gospel of peace and love and brotherhood. He had complained bitterly that my devil or saint feature in Muscle and Fitness, August 1981, that had done him a grave injustice and that it implied he had won his major titles by trickery and a little bit of help from his friends. But that was all behind him now. He was over the whole Australian brouhaha. He had reconciled himself to the resultant notoriety. He appeared sanguine, more than ever at ease with his star status. The sustained charges of the heavy-duty brigade had left no visible cracks on his self-confidence. As Arnold and his party followed a purposely underdressed waitress to their reserved table in the far corner of his favorite Santa Monica Boulevard restaurant, other male patrons suddenly discovered a keen interest in their shoelaces. Better to be observed at false pretense than to be caught in flagrante delicto in the hoi polloi act of gazing starry-eyed at a blue blazer personification of the American dream. On the other hand, their women, brazen as only California women can be, hungrily devoured Arnold with carnivorous Max Factor eyes. One particularly uninhibited wench rose from her escort side to littingly remind Arnold that they'd met before, that her writer husband was in New York working on some nameless film project or other, that she'd had, oh, absolutely so much fun, preparing the movie Pumping Iron for human consumption. Or was it the book that had given her untold pleasure? Upon Arnold's relentless recommendation, Diane settled for stuffed mushrooms and roast chicken, as her host had ordered for his personal pleasure. Her less adventurous husband stuck with prime rib rare. By a quarter to midnight, when the group had polished off huge chunks of crispy cheesecake and three or four large bottles of Johannesburg Riesling and were crapulously seeking comfort in cups of piping hot cafe espresso, the postprandial conversation had turned from reckless times in London and Munich to hazards of the foreseeable future, like the year's Olympia, for instance. It developed that where Arnold was concerned, Franco Colombo had taken a Sisyphean task upon himself when he chose the 81 Olympia as his comeback vehicle. For even if he proved worthy of the title, there would still be too many eager to swear the contest was fixed. The best Franco could hope for in such circumstances was a Cadmean victory achieved at ruinous cost to himself. By Arnold's account, Franco first hinted at a comeback while they were both in Australia for the troubled 1980 Olympia. Arnold had not taken his friend seriously at the time. But later, while they were filming Conan the Barbarian in Spain, Franco had repeated the threat, and Arnold knew for certain that more trouble was headed his way. He had tried to discourage Franco. Bitter experience had taught Arnold that it was no Easter party resurrecting a body after it had laid among the mothballs of retirement for 4 years. Arnold had pleaded with his friend to consider the great stress that Olympia preparations would place on the leg he had broken during a strongman contest back in 1977. All to no avail, of course. Franco was obviously determined to prove, if only to himself, that anything Arnold could do, he could do better, perhaps. Moreover, Franco had been most offended by the adverse reaction of the 80 Olympia contenders to Arnold's victory, and he had secretly promised himself to punish them for their displays of bad sportsmanship. By mid-June, Franco was well into his own war exercises. He'd begun by working like a man possessed on those areas of his anatomy where he historically he was weakest, his biceps, his triceps, his calves. For 3 months, he had resisted the urge to train his back. His lats had always responded well to the slightest stimulation. Working them had always been a labor of love, but war had been declared. This was no time for indulging in cibriotic pleasures. He burned up surplus energy by working his abdominal muscles and preparing his vulnerable thigh for the heavy work that was to come. Arnold had trained with Franco 5 times a week at Santa Monica's World Gym and had been amazed at the rapidity of his friend's improvement. In late August, they lectured together in Philadelphia at a seminar that preceded the year's Miss Olympia show, and both were showered with love by people who had loved them for more than a decade. After Franco had posed, the applause threatened the roof of the Philadelphia Sheraton. The mood was reminiscent of an earlier time when the Brooklyn Academy of Music was still the temple of a god named Larry Scott, and the worshipers traveled annually from all over his faithful world to do him homage. Franco was ecstatic when he took over the stage mic to acknowledge the deafening ovation that had rewarded his first unclad appearance before the public in 4 years. Finally, he had proved wrong the doctors who had gloomily informed him after his accident that he'd never walk again without a stick, let alone endure the trials of contest preparations. Frankly, it was Franco's courage that deserved the sustained applause, not his physique. For while he was quite possibly larger and thicker, especially in the arms and shoulders, than he'd ever been before, his body lacked the hardness and the sharp definition that was Franco's special hallmark in his heyday. No matter, he stood at the mic as if he had just won his 8th Olympia. "Thank you," he said. "Oh, thank you so very much. You like the posing?" And when the crowd had roared its approval, he said, "I put it together in the dressing room." More uninhibited applause. "I tell you what," he went on, "you tell me yes or no. You think maybe I should go in the Olympia?" Such showmanship, such finesse. Compared with the scheming Sardinian and the art of Khan, Mark Anthony was a first grader. Franco had sensed an opportunity to make 3,000 people synonymous with his Olympia comeback, and he had grabbed it in both hands. "Yes," came the unsurprising reply. "Franco, Mr. Olympia." And implicit in their response was the promise that they'd be marching behind Colombo in Columbus. "Right," said Franco, flashing the devastating little boy smile. "Now I take them by the neck." He called for the house lights to be turned on, and then he proceeded to introduce over the mic everyone in his audience who had ever sat before a typewriter. After such a display, what writer with a drop of humanity in his veins would say Franco was undeserving of the highest bodybuilding acolytes? Not even the infamous Rick Wayne would be so barbarian. By early September, when Arnold left Los Angeles on a book tour that would take him to 30 or 40 American cities, he'd begun to entertain the thought that Franco could well find himself among the first 5 Olympia winners come October 10th. It was a thought pregnant with ambivalence, of course, for while Arnold had always wished Franco well in his various undertakings, after all, Franco was still his closest friend, there was always the nagging reminder that victory in Columbus would be expensive, and Arnold was well aware that Franco would not be the only one to pay the high price. Since his return to Los Angeles, Arnold had not had time to further assess Franco's chances. Besides, the contender had removed himself to Hawaii, where he planned to lie unbothered in the sun and train in semi-seclusion at Timmy Leong's gym during the last few days before the Olympia. However, mutual friends had assured Arnold that even before Franco left for Hawaii, he had done such things to his body as would guarantee him a place among the first 3 heroes of the 81 Olympia. Arnold was looking forward to his 5th Olympia promotion. He and Jim Lorimer had cooked up some exciting surprises for the fans, but there was no escaping the anxieties that had clung like leeches to Arnold's soul from the moment he realized Franco was serious about his Olympia comeback. Indeed, from the onset, Arnold and Lorimer had privately shared fears that their established reputations as premier bodybuilding promoters would be on the line thanks to Franco's involvement in the 81 Olympia. Arnold had taken solace from the fact that the IFBB had picked the men who would be responsible for choosing the winner of the year's richest bodybuilding purse. For a change, the promoters would be accountable only for the Olympia show, not the contest. Still, Arnold could not shake the eerie feeling that no matter how the results came out, he would still be the fatted calf, the prime candidate for crucifixion. Lately, it had seemed to Arnold that there was this conspiracy to make him the scapegoat for every imagined bodybuilding faux pas. When all was said and done, he had done no more than be a contender at the 80 Olympia, no different from, say, Mensah or Zane or Dickerson, all of whom enjoyed star reputations. He hadn't picked the judges, and he had not promoted the event, but that had not prevented certain influential parties from conveniently saddling him with the full burden of responsibility for whatever gaffes had been committed in Sydney. Well, he had never shied away from criticism, constructive or otherwise. He stood to gain nothing from worrying about matters over which he had no control. The arrival of Wag and Diane in the city of Los Angeles had given him a rare opportunity to enjoy himself with friends who were genuine, to forget his troubles for a while. He looked forward to spending more time with the Bennetts on their return from Hawaii. Weeks earlier, he had mailed them complimentary tickets to the Olympia. It was a little after midnight when Arnold and his party left the restaurant on a guided tour of the new splendiferous Schwarzenegger residence. Later, back at their hotel, Arnold's friend said goodbye, thanked him for a wonderful time, promised to see him again in Columbus. The host had also had a joyous evening. 3 days after he left for Columbus, Lorimer had arranged television publicity for Franco and Dickerson, and Arnold had promised to participate. Not that the Olympia required further advertisement. By the first week of September, all tickets had disappeared. Contrary to the hopes and aspirations of a few well-muscled doomsayers, the 81 Olympia would be a sellout, and in more ways than one. Boyer Coe and Mike Mensah had remained rock steady in their resolve not to compete in Columbus. As a direct consequence of their concentrated attacks on Arnold and the men who had judged the Olympia in Sydney, Muscle and Fitness had been moved to churn out special features designed to counter the adverse publicity and allay the popular fear that there would be no Olympia in 81. While Arnold was busy filming Conan in Spain and the United States, his dedicated detractors were planning to stage a consolation show in New York for the fans in lieu of that year's Olympia. Interesting enough, while Coe and Mensah rocked the foundations of bodybuilding with indictments against its leading practitioners and the, quote, powers that be, the IFBB remained uncharacteristically mute, which is hardly the same as saying the Federation was altogether inactive. Indeed, there are those who suspect the IFBB helped a New York promoter decide that, due to short notice, it would be impossible for him to stage Mensah's consolation show before the 81 Olympia. A letter signed by the majority of those who participated in the Sydney affair, and which appeared at least one nationally circulated magazine, gave credence to the depressing prophecy that second raters alone would appear in the 81 Olympia, if indeed such a contest materialized at all. By the end of July, the rumors that Arnold had arranged for Franco's victory in Columbus was no longer a whisper among bodybuilding's in crowd. Now the word was out. Franco would win the Olympia, and Germany's Josef Wilkosch would be second. Wilkosch, a close friend of Arnold's, had won the Pro Mr. Universe title in 1980, and Arnold had promoted that contest. Upon Arnold's return from Spain, however, the ill wind had begun to subside. There was hardly a day when a concerned top-ranking Olympia contender did not call Arnold to swear allegiance to the Schwarzenegger fan club and promise to compete in Columbus. Evidently, the previously mentioned published letter of protest and its promised boycott had been forgotten. Clearly, the bruised ego had never had a more effective balm than time. They don't call him the Fox for nothing. Frank Zane had made it abundantly clear from January that his decision to stay out of the 81 Olympia had nothing whatsoever to do with the disaster that had been euphemistically labeled the Sydney affair. Zane had chosen to miss the contest in Columbus for two personal reasons. One, he wanted to train for a full year without the pressures that are part and parcel of Olympia preparations. And two, he wished to devote more time to Zane Haven, the resort that he and Christine own and operate in Palm Springs, California. Shortly after the 80 Olympia, Zane had expressed the plausible view that after some six assaults on the title, three of which had been successful, his physique held no further surprises for Olympia judges. So in his own best interest, he had decided to make conspicuous adjustments to his famous body before putting it on display again. Zane dismissed outright all suggestions that his decision had anything at all to do with the Olympia boycott proposed by Coe and Mensah. Apropos of Arnold's participation in the Sydney affair, Zane had said, "I talked with him a week before he left for Australia. I knew he signed to do the television commentary for CBS. We talked about my condition, my chances in the contest, my accident, and so on. He never once let on that he'd be competing. You never know with him. I was angry when I first saw him at the prejudging in Sydney, but later I felt sorry for him. I can't imagine what it could have tempted him to return looking as bad as he did. It couldn't have been the money. Tom Platz had made no secret of the fact that he planned to be among the leading contenders in the 81 Olympia. He had stubbornly refused to be swayed by the persistent adjurations of Mike Mentzer and Boyer Coe. He had turned up in Columbus, affable as always, and determined to win the 1980 Pro Mr. Universe title. True, he still believed he had been good enough in Australia to win, but he never once blamed Arnold for the results. Not once had he considered taking revenge on Arnold. Finally, he fought a desperate fight in the Pro Universe. When the dust settled, however, it was Josip Wilkosz who had emerged with the $10,000 check in his fist. Exactly as the bodybuilding tactics at Venice Beach had predicted, Tom had been forced into second place. Disappointment notwithstanding, he had refused to cry over stymied dreams. Instead, he had returned home to California more than ever determined to prevail in October. Those who know him know also that Tom is among the world's most dedicated bodybuilders. Just watching him take a regular workout is enough to make you sweat. Shortly before the California Grand Prix last March, Tom had turned up at the offices of this magazine looking for all the world like some abandoned marble that finally had proved too much for a soi disant Michelangelo. At 5'7", he weighed 240 pounds. Poetry in motion, he was not. For months, his training had been fueled by a mad dog determination to balance his upper body with his tremendous thighs and calves. He'd taken to doing repetition squats with weights up to 600 pounds in the belief that this would stimulate upper body mass, which did make sense to most people. Sound logic suggested squatting with such heavy weights would encourage his thighs to grow still more enormous, a catch-22 if ever there was one. Tom saw things differently. Experience had taught him that squats did not stimulate the thighs alone. They encouraged all-around body mass. Besides, he had finally decided not to train according to the dictates of others. Henceforth, he would follow his own instincts and rise or fall by his own hand. Other people's methods had not delivered the results he hungered for. Since the Pro Universe, he had taken to consuming 6,000 calories daily. He'd been going to bed around 9 each night. He awoke at 5:30, breakfasted on a frozen banana or some yogurt, and then headed for the gym. It was a dull existence, through the eyes of his girlfriend at any rate, but he had goals that superseded outside considerations. Before each workout, while he was eating his frozen banana or en route to the gym, he'd visualize himself squatting with over 600 pounds, dipping with weights in excess of 200. Tough, but by the time he arrived at the gym, even the heaviest barbells had become surmountable. Afterwards, during lunch maybe, he would mentally repeat what he'd done at the gym and work himself up to do still more at the next training session. Of course, he was preoccupied throughout the day. His poor girlfriend found it impossible to reach him. He was not the easiest person in the world to live with. But those were the breaks. Self-hypnosis had become an important part of his Olympia preparations. After he achieved his dream, hell, there'd be lots of time. Here, he giggled, to be normal. His body weight at the 1980 Olympia had been 195 pounds. Too light, he later decided. For the Columbus contest, he would gradually come down from 240, 245 to a diamond-hard, dazzling 225 pounds. Everything was going exactly according to plan. Tom Platz was in control. Experience had taught Roy Callender that training in California was best for him, so once again, he had deserted home and family, even his baby daughter, to undergo the totally revolutionary operations that would transform him into prime Olympia meat by October 10th. Roy had come a long way since 1976. He was no longer the meowing pussycat that could be intimidated by the likes of Robbie Robinson and Danny Padilla. He had grown tough from the vicissitudes of life on the Grand Prix treadmill. By now, he was no longer susceptible to the rantings of overambitious dreamers. He had placed second to Chris Dickerson in the first Grand Prix in 1981. He weighed just short of 225 pounds, and many were of the opinion that he'd been at least as muscular as Dickerson. Well, the 81 Olympia would give him the ideal opportunity for revenge. For 3 months, he trained 6 days a week, twice daily, 6 hours a day. He worked with an intensity seldom seen even at World's Gym. His mind was like a steel trap that once it had been sprung, could not be reopened without a special key. And Roy alone had that key. Everyone said he'd lost his sense of humor, the Caribbean affability for which he was particularly well known. Some said he'd become something a step away from inhuman. If Roy heard, he paid little attention. There were other things on his mind, bigger fish to be fried. fish like Chris and Tom and Danny and Franco. Danny Padilla had long been every mother's ideal Mr. Universe. His puppy dog eyes had melted the toughest female souls at Muscle and Fitness, and seasoned matrons had been moved to wax dithyrambic in his presence. Pity that none of them had sat on the adjudicating panel that picked the 1980 Mr. Olympia. Not that Danny had been particularly upset by the goings-on in Australia. He'd always admired Arnold for his winning mass and definition combination. Indeed, many informed writers had over the years bemoaned the fact that Danny had apparently never given the disciplines that would give him the cuts he so admired in Arnold. Danny has the perfect physique, everyone said. His symmetry was flawless. If only he'd turn up ripped. Well, Danny had quit his California apartment and returned to his native Rochester, New York, soon after the Sydney affair. For months, the West Coast heard nothing about him. As far as everyone in Santa Monica was concerned, the giant killer had retired. He had hung up the axe that had served him so well in his battles against such Neanderthals as Mike Mentzer and Roy Callender. In fact, Danny had simply removed himself to a place where he had made his best bodybuilding gains. And he married his sweetheart, Candy. The bodybuilder's California existence had become too boring for Danny. He'd never been the type to live solely for the beach and the gym. In Rochester, he returned to work at the family grocery store. But Danny never retired from bodybuilding. How could he when the Olympia still remained unconquered? He had won the Mr. America title and the Mr. Universe, too. At 5'2", he was probably the shortest man ever to achieve such bodybuilding distinction. But what good was that without the Olympia? Danny had returned to serious training a short time after resettling in Rochester. He had teamed up with his super training partner, a New York lawyer named Larry Baker, and together they set about getting Danny ready to kill some more giants. Last August, Danny guested at the Miss Olympia show with Ron Tufel and Franco Colombo. He was big, if a little smooth on top, but there was a telling hardness in his thighs and lower back, and his calves were as remarkable as ever. He told reporters he fully intended to compete in the 81 Olympia, even though certain people had assured him the contest had been fixed for Franco to win. He said he would be in such amazing form, the fixers, if in fact they existed, would have to change their mind in order to save face. Larry Baker promised to unleash a totally new Danny Padilla on Olympia Day. The giant killer just smiled. Poor Samir Banute. He had been so certain of victory in Australia, he was bigger than he'd ever been in his life. And in his bathroom mirror the day before he boarded the Pan Am jet for Sydney, he'd been ripped to the bone. Something had happened en route to the 80 Olympia, however. Somewhere along the way, Samir's system had flooded. On the morning of the prejudging, he pinched the skin of his pectorals just to make certain he wasn't hallucinating, and his worst fears had been confirmed. There was far too much water in his tissues, even for his bodybuilding good. Ever since he spent time with Serge Nubret, his dreams had become waterlogged. The guys at the gym liked to make jokes about his predicament, as if there was something funny about it. Meanwhile, everything he lived for was floating down the sewer. Samir went through the motions in Sydney, but his heart was not in his efforts. And in the end, he was unmoved by the results that had driven others to the edge of sanity. For by then, he had set his mind on the future. The first thing Samir did upon returning to his Santa Monica apartment was flush his supply of steroids down the toilet. Henceforth, he would train naturally. It was now obvious that the pill had not been invented that could turn a man into Mr. Olympia. He had to be born with the right bone structure, the right mental disposition, the right genes. Everyone said Samir's symmetry had been unmatched in 1977. Well, you don't get that from injections. So a few days after the 80 Olympia, Samir returned to Gold's Gym to pick up where he'd left off, to train as he had for his appearance in George Snyder's Best in the World contest and the Mr. Universe. He'd been at his best for those events. He was scheduled to compete in the 1981 World Championships last February. He trained for this event as if indeed his bodybuilding life depended on how he made out in Atlantic City. But the trip from California had somehow interfered with his definition, and at the last minute, Samir decided to pull out. There was no point in competing when he wasn't at his best. He returned home with his mind more than ever set on conquering whatever psychic demons had been sabotaging his efforts. And as the months rolled by, Samir's perseverance began to pay off. By the end of August, he was his old self again, telling everyone he met that he was ready to take on the world. He took to training at both Gold's and World's gyms, anything to combat boredom. He shared workout sessions with Callender and Platts and Dickerson. And nothing he saw in those men was sufficient to make Samir run. For finally, he had tapped the source of his problems. When disaster strikes, a man must sink or swim. Well, Samir had known rough times. More than once, he had faced death in his native Lebanon. He'd always been a survivor, and now he was determined to have the last laugh. When it comes to thin skin, you won't find any thinner than Chris Dickerson's. Not so long ago, I wrote a feature for this magazine entitled, I Feel Like Bodybuilding's Jackie Robinson. It was a piece that gave me particular pleasure in its preparation. I had looked forward to writing it as atonement for certain inaccurate thoughts about Chris that I'd harbored for too long. I knew there were too many other bodybuilders who felt the same as I did about this champion. The article would help clear up the record, I imagined. John Foster, my editor at Muscle and Fitness, was touched by the piece. It portrayed a highly intelligent, if misunderstood, individual. It would be well received by Dickerson's fans. And it was. We received numerous letters from readers in all sections of the United States, all full of harmonious praise for the Dickerson profile. Only one man was thoroughly disgusted. Yes, you guessed it, Chris Dickerson. We met in Las Vegas at the time of the American Championships and almost came to blows. It seemed like I made some forgettable reference to his maligned arms in some previous feature, and that had rendered the thin-skinned Dickerson oversensitive to everything I wrote afterwards. I never quite grasped what it was about the Jackie Robinson piece that had offended Dickerson, but his reaction was enough to betray my faith in human nature. I decided then and there that my writing skills would suffer no great catastrophe if I never again wrote another word about this man who is so touchy about his arm development, never mind that he still happens to be one of the best champions our sport has ever had. I changed my mind. I put Dickerson's Las Vegas outburst down to the side effects of Spartan dieting. I'd been through that myself. How much worse must it be for Dickerson, who was on a rigid diet for the greater part of each year? I wish to say here that I've never seen Dickerson win a single contest he did not deserve. And when he showed up at Weider 3 or 4 days before the 81 Olympia, I did not doubt for 1 minute that he would finally pick up the title that so many said he thoroughly deserved in 1980. He said he was some 5 pounds heavier than usual, and yet from what I could see in his face, his upper packs, and his forearms, his definition had never been better. He'd had a wonderful year, save for 2 disappointments against Coe and Beckles. He'd made a lot of money, he was happy, and he had every reason to expect more joy from the events of October 10th. Before Dickerson left me, he said he still had a good 5 years in him, and fully expected to be at the top in 1986. I believed him, up to that point at any rate. Joe Weider had learned enough in 30 years to avoid making statements, rash or otherwise, pertaining to bodybuilding championships. With so much money riding on titles these days, Joe has become frustratingly careful about predictions. So it was with some surprise that I heard him remark how wonderful Franco looked during a photo session shortly before he left for Hawaii. Joe did not actually say he thought Franco would win in Columbus, mind you, but it seemed to me that he was deliberately stopped short of that. The fact that he actually expressed this opinion of Franco a few days before the Olympia was uncharacteristic. And in my prejudiced subconscious, I heard more than Joe had actually volunteered. So I said, come on, Joe, what about the guy's legs? You know he can't train them hard as they would have liked to. And Joe had quickly replied, don't misunderstand me. I think Franco is underestimating the competition. He's done a fantastic job on his upper body, but I told him he'd need another year before he's ready for the Olympia. His legs require particular attention after the accident. They won't respond as quickly as his upper body has. Franco needs more time. Later, I received calls from John Balick and Artie Zeller. Balick was cagey. He said he'd only made some slides of plats and that the guy is awesome. Artie left the impression that he'd be a lot happier if Franco changed his mind about competing. Not that Artie had no faith in Franco, you understand. Rather, he felt his circumstances of his comeback were far from ideal. He did say Franco was in the best shape of his life, however. Which leaves the matter of Bertel Fox. Yes, I know there was this feature in Muscle and Fitness wherein I suggested Bertel had come to America with particular intentions about that year's Olympia. Well, the flesh and spirit were willing, but a new IFBB rule got in the way. Bertel must first qualify before he can be eligible to compete for bodybuilding's richest prize. He must win his first IFBB event or place high enough to be worthy of competing against Steve Davis, Ed Corney, and the rest. Bertel will have complied with the rules by 1982. Promise. So it seemed the fans were in for one hell of a time in Columbus. Every contender you spoke with was definitely in the greatest shape of my life and determined to be Mr. Olympia in 1981. They all acted as if Franco had changed his mind about competing. And when you brought the matter up, not one contender even suggested the Sardinian might be a threat in Columbus. So what the hell went wrong? More important, did something actually go wrong? Next month, I'll give you the nitty-gritty. exactly as they dug it out of the judges, the fans, the promoters, and the contenders. Here's further proof that Muscle and Fitness does not hold back the facts. Joe Weider has always tried to publish a magazine worthy of your trust. And the Mr. Olympia story, as I've written it, is further proof of our publisher's honesty and integrity. I'll take you behind the scenes and I'll show you how the Olympia judges were picked in 1981. I'll tell you who picked them and why. Nothing will be held back. Under the circumstances, it's the least we at Muscle Fitness can do. Don't miss our next issue. All right, then they have another smaller article here written by Oscar State, who is the secretary of the judges committee. And it says, observation on the judges' marks in the 1981 Mr. Olympia contest. The full analysis shows that there was no large majority vote for Franco Colombo in first place. Only two judges placed him first. They were Doug Evans from Wales and Franco Fossi from Italy. Jim Mannion placed him first in a tie with Danny Padilla. Two judges, Winston Roberts from Canada and Sven Ole Thorsen from Denmark, placed Chris Dickerson first. Dominic Serto placed Tom Platz first, and Jacques Blumhardt placed Roy Callender first. It's apparent that Colombo won because he obtained more second-place marks than the other competitors. Here is how each judge placed his first three competitors. Dominic Serto from the USA had Tom Platz in first, Roy Callender second, and Franco also in second in a tie. Doug Evans from Wales had Franco first, Chris Dickerson second, Tom Platz third. Winston Roberts from Canada had Chris Dickerson first, Franco second, and Tom Platz third. Franco Fossi from Italy had Franco first. Roy Callender and Chris Dickerson tied for second. Jim Mannion from the USA had Danny Padilla and Franco tied for first, and then Tom Platz in third. Jacques Blumhardt from Belgium had Roy Callender first, Tom Platz second, and Chris Dickerson third. And Sven Ole Thorsen from Denmark had Chris Dickerson first, Franco Colombo second, and Tom Platz third. Those results indicate the closeness of the top men between the top four guys, Franco, Chris Dickerson, Tom Platz, and Roy Callender. And also that the judges did mark their papers objectively and independently, naming between them five different winners. Their marking was consistently at a high level of accuracy, with the exception of Sven Ole Thorsen. Here are the judges' accuracy scores. Dominic Serto from the USA is 100%. Doug Evans from Wales is 100%. Winston Roberts from Canada is 98%. Franco Fossi from Italy, 98%. And Jim Mannion from the USA, 96%. Jacques Blumhardt from Belgium, 92.2%. And Sven Ole Thorsen from Denmark, 60.8%. The alternate judge, Riko Matayumo from Japan, placed Franco first, Chris Dickerson second, Roy Callender third, and an accuracy mark of 94.1. All right, and then they got the judges' score sheets here, and man, they broke it down. Every round with every judge scores, which they don't do anymore. They just give you the final score, but this one really shows what each judge placed everybody. And they also had the Mr. International contest with the Olympia. Ralph Pierce was the lightweight winner. Shigeru Shigeta from Japan, the famous NABBA Mr. Universe, he took the middleweight. Light heavyweight class went to Ali Mala, and the heavyweight class went to Scott Wilson, who also won the overall. All right. So I hope you guys enjoyed that article as much as I did. We got part two coming up next week, so I hope you'll be here for that, plus another wonderful interview on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, everybody, train hard, take care of yourself, and we'll see you guys next week. Bye-bye.